This time on the Plutopia podcast, we explore how AI can help empower a person's search for answers to a critical medical issue.
Access to information was a huge limiting factor in how much we could do. And that has changed a lot, but there was an article about patients using AI in the New York Times this summer, and it said Google is like a librarian, but AI gives you access to clinical thinking, clinical thought, and it has just caused an explosion in the things that people can do. And I'll cite two examples, Jill, and then I'll hand it to you. A trivial example is when I get back from a doctor visit now, because of open notes and federal policy, I'm allowed to read all the gobbledygook that the doctors put in the computer. And what I do is I copy paste that into ChatGPT and I say, summarize this. What are my action items? And it digests the whole thing and says, here are the problems you worked on today. Here's what you're doing about it. And here are your next steps.
Welcome, everybody, to yet another episode of the Plutopia News Network podcast. I'm here with my partner and co-host, Scoop Sweeney, who has the flu and will be pretty silent today, I think. But we have three guests to make up for that. Dave DeBroncart, known as ePatient Dave, who is an international speaker on healthcare, health IT, and a patient advocate par excellence. Gilles Friedman is a pioneer of online health communities. He was the founder of the Association of Cancer Online Resources, or ACOR, way back in 1995.
He continues to be a freaking visionary on what is...
That's for sure.
No kidding. You know, it should be said, just for full disclosure to the audience, ACOR, that he founded in 1995, helped save my life in 2007. So I have a stake in the validity of his opinions.
And you're not the only one, right?
Right.
Well, let me just introduce Hugo here. Hugo Campos is also with us. In the past, he's been a creative director, an art director, a visual designer, a marketer, a computer programmer, a presentation coach. But we know him and love him as an advocate for patient autonomy, accountability, and access to health data. And all of us, all myself included, have been involved in the Society for Participatory Medicine for some years, and have worked off and on as patient advocates. And I see that Hugo dropped off, but hopefully he'll be back in a minute.
Yep.
Gilles, did you have more to say about your current activities?
I've been working a lot with Hugo and Dave about promoting the concept that patients should use AI. Many of them are already using AI, and explaining that it is definitely promoting a new form of autonomy, much more than what we were able to do until now. But it's also not a trivial use. So I hope that Hugo is going to join us back, because he wrote something absolutely amazing today, basically explaining what are the three fundamental things that people need to learn and do in order to be able to use AI at its full potential.
Yeah, we can send a link to include in the show notes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But
sorry,
well, go ahead.
So you know me, I'm a born contrarian. So I
can't imagine that.
So I also like to see what doesn't work with AI, and I probably will say a couple of things about it.
Well, so my first question here would be, either of you, do you have stories of patients who are currently making good use of AI and supporting their healthcare decisions?
I'm going to suggest, I mean, we have many, and I want to point out that they range from the amazingly sophisticated, like the stuff that Hugo and Jill do, to the amazingly trivial, like the stuff that I do. I'm going to suggest that we start with the point that what's going on here, and this goes right back to everything Tom Ferguson preached, you know, the medical self-care, he wrote that magazine and that book of that name, and it was all about how the vast majority of what happens in healthcare is people taking care of themselves and their families at home. And so there's this incredibly important question of what caps their contribution, right? And he, when the web came along and he published that book, you know, Health Online in 1996, he pointed out that access to information was a huge limiting factor in how much we could do. And that has changed a lot. But there was an article about patients using AI in the New York Times this summer, and it said, Google is like a librarian, but AI gives you access to clinical thinking, clinical thought, and it has just caused an explosion in the things that people can do. And I'll cite two examples, Jill, and then I'll hand it to you. A trivial example is, when I get back from a doctor visit now, because of open notes in federal policy, I'm allowed to read all the gobbledygook that the doctors put in the computer. And what I do is I copy paste that into ChatGPT and I say, summarize this. What are my action items? And it digests the whole thing and says, here are the problems you worked on today. Here's what you're doing about it. And here are your next steps. And that just makes it 1,000 times easier for me to follow the care plan. You know, we used to say, well, patients have bad health literacy. And my point was always, now, I'm not going to talk about literacy until you talk about the clarity of the junk you want us to understand. And this just eliminates that. And at the other end of the scale is the story that I hope Hugo will share with us about his the extraordinary, he solved a horrible problem last year with his elderly father, who he's the caregiver for and lives with him, without ever seeing a doctor because the doctor's appointment was 3 months away. So here we are, victims of the stupid U.S. health system. Hugo just took action, and he's a wizard at using these tools. And the point here, as Jill said, is that what we're on the verge of, what is starting to unfold, is real autonomy, the ability to pursue whatever interests you want for as long as you want and take it in whatever direction you want without anybody saying, sorry, our time is up, or where's your insurance? So, Jill?
Yeah. Keep on talking about autonomy and empowerment. So we always say that there is nothing free, right? And autonomy, which we gain by using AI, does not come for free either. It comes with the fact that we have to become much more responsible for our health and what we do, how we interact with the healthcare system. And AI is an absolutely incredible tool to help us doing this. We can become educated enough so we can have really rational conversations with the clinicians that we are going to end up seeing. And in many cases, we're going to get answers from the systems that allow us to not have to interact with the system. It's pretty powerful. I just heard this morning somebody living in Barcelona who had a story very similar to what Hugo is going to tell us about, like how he helped his father.
Yeah, Hugo, the question was about whether anyone could offer actual experiences of patients using, very effectively using AI for their health. And Dave and Gilles mentioned that you had just written something today that may be relevant to that. What was it that you wrote? What do we...
Yeah, thanks, John. I appreciate that. Thanks for repeating the question. I feel like we're all learning how to navigate this together, and I think there are a lot of very valuable lessons that we've learned over the course of the last 2 years since GPT 3.5 was launched. I think in November of 2022. So, one of the lessons that I have learned that I've been trying to share with folks is to be, I would say, platform agnostic, I suppose, or AI agnostic. And that's at least a lesson that I've learned that works, has worked for me. And it really, there are so many different models, not only language models, but companies that are offering these models, tools that use different models, like Perplexity, for example. It seems XAI has Grok, Meta has the Llama open source model. Not to go through every single one of them, but I used all of these different tools differently. And I think with that it comes, of course, the benefits that each unique platform offers, but also the risks that are a little bit different with each different platform. In the post that I posted today, it's already generating some controversy. I didn't mean for it to be controversial, but I received a call earlier today from a fellow advocate who finds that the mention of the Chinese model from DeepSeek, DeepSeek R1, that I mentioned in the post, to be dangerous, I suppose, and I try to be careful in the way that I framed it. I am not a security expert. And I recognize there are risks in not only with the quality of the output that you get from these models, but also with the risks that come along with it in terms of sending your information over the web, perhaps all the way to China. So, or to a black box, a company that may use your information to train another model or for their own financial gain. All of these are risks that we should take into account. And I don't claim to know what those risks are. I use these tools as carefully as I can, and use my critical thinking as much as I can, to make the best decisions that I can about how I go using these tools. And I'll just allude to the problem that I Dave mentioned with my dad that I tried to solve last year. At some point, patients must make a judgment in terms of where they stand, in terms of how much risk they're willing to take and with their information and their health information as they use these tools, and how desperate they might be for a solution to a problem that they may be facing, either with themselves or their loved one or something like this. In my case, I had an appointment that was scheduled months away, and my dad was suffering, and we made a judgment, him with me. It wasn't something I decided on my own. I abhor paternalism, so I mentioned it to him, and I said, we'll do this together, and let's see if the AI can help us. And in our case, it turned out that it was able to help us, and it gave us relief.
I really want people to understand what you did. And I don't know if I know you've been really busy today. I don't know if you want to recount the steps you took, which you put into the blog post. Everybody should know we have a blog called Patients Use AI. You can just Google Patients Use AI blog and it'll come up. And Hugo's story, or Hugo, do you want me to recap it? Or
well, I I can tell you a little bit about what happened. So yeah, Dan had one day in the spring of last year, he suddenly appeared with a rash all over his body, and it took over very quickly. It started off, I think, in his legs, and it went up his body, and we scheduled an appointment with the PCP, with the primary care, and she says, "Well, this is some kind of dermatitis. I don't know. I think we should. You should see a dermatologist." So she gave us a referral. I scheduled the appointment. The appointment was 4 months away, and the problem kept getting worse. 4 months away, yeah, and it was almost unbelievable. And in fact, I went back to the PCP and I said, "It's 4 months away," and she gave me another referral, and it was just as far away as the first appointment. So we kept it.
And 20 years old.
Yeah, he's 94, and he was suffering, complaining, and at first I said, you know, we'll just wait and figure, we'll just wait and we'll see how it goes. I didn't think it was anything that was going to be, I mean, it's a skin problem, but it was not something I perceived as to be too serious. But he was miserable. And one day I brought his breakfast in his room, and he was sitting up in bed, and he says, "I can't live like this. I can't live like this. I can't sleep. This itches all night, and it's very uncomfortable. This is driving me mad." And I said, "Well, we're going to have to do something." So what I did was pick up the notes. Thank goodness for Open Notes. So I downloaded the clinical notes from the visit with the PCP. I figured grabbing the most recent results from blood test results would be reasonable. So I pulled that up as well. I got photos of the rash that I took all over the body. In fact, I had used those photos to do a Google search to see if I could diagnose it, but I couldn't tell the difference. And so from one thing from another. And so I put all these in the AI, the pictures, the clinical notes, the pictures of the rash and the blood test results. And I also included a document that we had written out with a Google document that I exported as a PDF that contained some of the subjective symptoms, the complaints that he had. And so we put all that, and I by that time, I had been playing with these tools for about a year, and so I knew how to prompt the LLM. And I used a bunch of them. I didn't use just one. I used GPT-4, Gemini. I think I may have used Claude as well. And Dave documented it really well. In fact, Dave has all the prompting on his blog on the Patients Use AI Substack. If anybody wants to see exactly in detail what I did, it's all documented by Dave. And so I put all the information in the on the LLMs, and I started asking questions about. And the way I approached it was, I wanted to see the thinking of the machine. And so I said, "Well, give me the differential diagnosis and the rationale." And I asked for a table with three columns. The first column would be the differential diagnosis in order of likelihood. The second column, I wanted the machine to provide the thinking. Why do you think it's that? And the third column, I wanted the intervention, because I thought, well, if I don't really care about the diagnosis, and even if the machine is wrong about the diagnosis, I don't really care, because I'm looking is for relief. And so if the intervention is the same for two or three different diagnoses, then we'll just go for the intervention, and I don't care about the diagnosis until we see the doctor, since we're going to see the doctor in a few months anyway. And so What was an interesting that the result of it was that something that the doctors, none of them pointed out, so the AI was superior in this aspect, was in the fact that the AI pointed to the possibility that there was a connection between chronic kidney disease and the skin rash that was manifesting in his body. And nobody had pointed us out to that. And one of the suggestions that the AI did in the intervention was to alternate showers every other day with lukewarm water, and that's not what we had been doing. He was taking very hot showers every single day, and very long ones, as a matter of fact. And that was advised against by the AI. And so we made that shift, and since the AI pointed to the potential connection with chronic kidney disease, we also made an adjustment to the diet to a more kidney-friendly diet. And that improved significantly in a matter of just 2 weeks. By the time we saw the dermatologist, the problem had resolved. And in fact, the dermatologist didn't even have a copy of the blood test results because they were in a different system. I even asked her, because I just couldn't help myself. I said, after spending billions and billions of dollars in meaningful use, you don't have access to, what is this thing? I thought I would never hear this excuse of, there are Stanford's in a different health system and I don't have access to their records. And so some of the problems remain the same after we spent billions of our own money, of taxpayer money, in trying to solve these problems. So to me, it sort of reinforces that, we're really on this world on our own. We have ourselves to rely on, and we can't really, autonomy really is probably the solution, and AI may be the thing that really helps empower patients to be better advocates for ourselves.
So yeah. That raises a question for me, which is, you understood how to write prompts. You had some experience working with large language models, and you also had quite a bit of experience as an evolving e-patient, I would say. I mean, as somebody who has really come to kind of understand how to work with medicine and the medical community and so forth. So you had a great deal of knowledge that you brought to that particular situation. And my concern is, how do we get the average patient to the point where they can approach AI with that same, that same, maybe not that same body of knowledge, but in an informed way and write meaningful prompts and that sort of thing?
So, Gilles, that's for anybody. Right in your wheelhouse.
Yes.
Yeah, Gilles. So,
remember what we did with ACOR. That's basically what we did with ACOR. We had those communities that helped educate hundreds of thousands of people, many of which came without understanding anything about how the medical world works, not knowing anything about science, not understanding anything following the initial diagnosis of cancer. And as you know, many types of cancer, especially the more unusual ones, are incredibly complex diseases, with the majority of oncologists that understand very little about it. Those communities were able to help educate people. Within a month, they understood enough to be able to have rational conversations with other patients and then take whatever came out of those rational conversations to their physicians and, in many cases, request tests that the doctors didn't even know existed. We helped save the lives of tens of thousands of people by just having one community that told the patients that came in, who described their diagnosis, telling them that they almost certainly had been misdiagnosed because they, in fact, had a newly discovered type of cancer, and that their physician almost certainly didn't know about it. And based on their description, they had to go back to their physician and request a genetic test. And in a majority of cases, the people came back and said, thank you very much. I do have this mutation. And all of a sudden, instead of having a life expectancy of less than 8 months,
yep,
something similar to what Dave went through, many of those people, almost 30 years later, are still here. So we are going to go and do the same with AI. And I am convinced that we're going to create a patient academy for like how to use AI, because it's not trivial. It requires really understanding. Unfortunately, people will have to understand a little more about how these systems work. We talk about AI and LLMs, but in fact, it's more complicated than this. So I'll take the example of what Hugo said. He wrote this beautiful and really powerful post today about the framework to use AI to its maximum ability. And because he mentioned DeepSeek R1, he already got a call from somebody complaining. So as one of the guys who like immediately said, I don't trust DeepSeek. Look, if you type Taiwan, you can't get a response from it. I'm going to make it a little more clear. You have the models, which are basically the databases. And then you have a wrapper around it to which you ask questions. So the model itself has some form of, I would say some form of censorship, but that's not so bad. But you can take it, first of all, it's open source. So you can take it and put it on a machine in the United States and use a wrapper based in the US. And all the issues, most of the security issues that you have when you went to the deepseek.com website, which is in China, suddenly disappear, which is why Hugo and me have already used R1 on Perplexity. And I don't have to worry at all about the security issues.
Well, I worry that we're going to fry the brains of innocent listeners who are just curious about what's going on with all this stuff. I'm amazed at how rapidly the time is going by. If you think about, I don't know how many of your listeners are familiar with Tom Ferguson's e-patient white paper, but that was the manifesto published just after Tom died that I read in early 2008 that just turned my life around on a dime. And it starts with the story of a guy going, and this is like end of the empowerment and autonomy timeline. It starts with a guy in 1994, a patient who got busted for impersonating his doctor because he wanted to see an article, the only article about the surgery that the doctor was about to do on him. He wanted to understand what this knee surgery was about. And he called up and pretended he was the doctor and said, could you leave the article on a table outside the medical library for me? But security busted him. And the whole thing is knowledge is power, and access to it is what can liberate people. This exactly parallels, I often use the parallel of the women's health movement in the 1970s in Boston, where Miriam Hawley, one of the founders, said we weren't getting the information we needed. We couldn't get our questions answered, so we decided to get it ourselves. And they ended up writing this book, Our Women, Our Bodies, Ourselves. Yes, John?
Well, I just want to say, I think you kind of have to say knowledge properly understood is power.
Absolutely.
Because you do have a potential problem of people getting the knowledge and not really comprehending what it is they're seeing. And I think that's always been, I think, an issue within participatory medicine. You can't necessarily expect a patient, just kind of like average man on the street patient, to necessarily understand, say, looking at open notes, I've looked at clinical notes on surgeries I've had and visits I've had and so forth. I get it pretty well because I've been stewing in these juices for a long time. I can I can well imagine somebody being totally baffled by what they're seeing, though.
So this okay, you go first, Shil.
So this is where, again, those LLMs are incredibly powerful. They can transform whatever is written in any type of language in eighth grade English. You don't understand what got out of Google, and Google was never there to help explain to you what it pulled out. Those systems not only can pull out anything, they can also explain to you at whatever depth you need to have.
Yes.
So that you end up understanding clearly what it brought back to you.
And that's incredibly important for this whole point about autonomy, taking it whatever direction you want. Unlike being in a classroom or in a doctor visit where you're time limited on how long they can spend on your curiosity or your confusion, you can go on with this thing. You can take that first response and say, I don't understand. Could you say that more simply? And then you can take one particular item out of it and say, what does this mean? I've never heard of this, right? And well, what's the difference between that and this? It's the only learning environment I've ever seen that allows me without limit to keep asking questions like an insatiable three-year-old, which I've been accused of.
Yeah, basically interrogating.
Well, or just asking and asking. I'm still curious.
Yeah,
And a really important thing, some people think that we need to make all people start doing this. As a guy who worked in marketing for my whole career before cancer, I can tell you it's really hard to get people to do a new behavior if they don't have a problem, right? Where this becomes juicy is where somebody is stuck or where they're anxious. They want to know the answer to something. And then they have a reason to pick up this tool. A great simple example, there's a famous, that's on the Patients Use AI blog, there's a famous patient advocate named Sue Sheridan. Now, she is famous because she had two tragedies in her family. Her son ended up with cerebral palsy at childbirth because they never got around to doing a bilirubin test on him. And then a few years later, her husband died because his pathology report got filed without any human ever looking at it. So she's got plenty of reason to be wise about the system. Well, she had some weird symptom last summer, and they live in the mountains of Idaho, and they drove 3 hours down to the big city emergency room where the wizard damn doctor said, well, you didn't have a stroke, so just some benign neglect would be a good idea, and sent them home. And it just didn't feel right. So she had never touched, you don't have to be a Hugo to get value out of this. She had never touched AI, but she went to ChatGPT and she typed in her symptoms, and it came back and said, among other things, could be Bell's palsy. And if it is, it has to get treated within 72 hours or your facial group could be permanent. So they went to a different, more local emergency room, presented that, and they said, you know, you're right, this looks like Bell's palsy, right? The ability of an ordinary person to get access to clinical thinking is unprecedented. Okay, somebody else's turn.
Hugo, Hugo has some things.
Yeah, I wanted to add to this sort of thread, which is interesting. I want to get across the sort of to answer your question from earlier, John, of what patients need to learn. It's not just about the technical skills. I don't want folks feel like intimidated by having to learn something that may seem very complex. I think there are sort of three things that patients should exercise, or people in general who want to use these tools. Number one, I think, is to learn how to use how to ask questions. And I think if you practice being a communicator, being very clear in the way that you articulate the problem or that you articulate the question, that you can, and you can use the LLM to help you that, but have clarity, not only in the problem that you're trying to way that your question. So that's a that I think is important to learn. A second skill when using these tools as a patient is to understand that you, the more context you give these tools, the better is the likelihood of getting a higher quality answer. And so, and this is a lot of times means that you may take some, or that you would end up taking some risk by putting, say, for example, the clinical note in the LLM, or putting your blood test results. And some folks may say, you know, I'm going to redact the date of birth, or I'm going to redact the name, or and you may be able to get, you don't have to expose your date of birth in order to get a good quality answer. So there are ways of using these tools in a kind of a smart way. So that's skill number two. So knowing how to give the machine enough context. And the third one is really about knowing, it's not exactly a skill, but it's kind of an attitude. It's knowing that not to delegate decision-making to these tools. So it's not really about, a lot of times we may feel compelled to delegate the task to the AI, and it may be something sort of like the direction that we're going or that we seem to be heading with the introduction of agents. And with agents, you will be asked or be compelled, or the sort of the model is to really delegate. And we may be comfortable delegating smaller tasks to an agent. Agents by agents, I should probably define at least how I think of agents, are AI tools that have some level of autonomy. But in terms of the third sort of skill set, is important to remember that you should not delegate the big decisions, and you should retain your ability to your critical thinking, your ability to make the decision in the end that you think is best for yourself. Do not delegate that. That's how I kind of go about these using these tools, at least now. It may change in the future, I suppose, but those are the three things that I think are sort of foundational.
So you,
I've got a question for you, Gilles. Oh, go ahead.
Just a second. Hugo forgot to mention the sentence that he came up with that we are all mentioning all the time. He says, AI, I'm not looking at AI to give me answers. I'm looking at it to help me think. And really, this is the fundamental thing. Using those tools help us figure out how to better do reasoning. And now that those tools are starting to have internal reasoning, we're going to learn to do better and better reasoning. I'm using those tools every day, and I can see the effect it has on my ability to think beforehand. How am I going to ask a question, and what am I really looking for? They are really cognitive enhancement tools. This is, it's something we have never seen before, and I can only really tell people you should definitely try to use it. It's going to transform how you think.
Yeah, I think the biggest value of AI is it has to be combined with human intelligence and human discretion.
Sure.
So Gilles, the question I had for you, you know, we talked earlier about ACOR, which is the community you built, and how effective it was. And you mentioned that you're interested in building an academy?
Yes.
And I'm wondering, what would be the difference between the community approach and the academy approach?
I'm not sure that there is a big difference. Hopefully we're going to be able to build a large community where people help each other figure out how to ask questions, how to get answers, and how to learn how to do this reasoning.
What is
many
does
questions. I mean, this is really remember, this is a technology which is 2 years old. It's like really in its infancy. And look how fast it has changed and evolved and exploded. We can't even imagine. If you remember, we were all listening to, I can't remember his name, Mr. Kelly, who told us, think
Kevin
about
Kelly.
Kevin Kelly.
Yeah, told us, quantified self.
Remember, like he asked us a question, do you remember how was the world 5,000 days ago? And we said, like, yeah, what is he talking about? That was like 5,000 days after the birth of the iPhone. So just imagine what will be 5,000 days after the arrival of ChatGPT 3.5. We can't even imagine. We can't imagine what's going to happen next week. Like 2 weeks ago, DeepSeek R1 didn't exist, and OpenAI was the king of the universe. And all of a sudden, it's no longer the king of the universe. So we can expect that we're going to see changes all the time. Nonetheless, if we build communities where people can come and get answers, simple answers or complex answers. We are not, I mean, the fight against paternalism is to never think that we know better than people what they should know. Just let's build communities and let's see how they can help each other, and we can always provide some guidance.
Well, and the thing
I was just wondering
hope...
if there's, let me just ask real quick. Is there some structural difference in the approach you want to take now that leads you to call it an academy rather than a community?
So no, but I thought of academy because the way I learned about it was more structured than how I learned things until now. And I think that maybe better structure may be useful in this case because it's all computer based. And if we have structure, it's easier to learn. I think is going to happen, what I hope is going to happen, is that we're going to be able to build something that was never done before, which is a hybrid that's going to put together online communities with AI. I can't think today of how do you separate the two.
Fantastic. Well,
one thing that seems obvious to me is that we ought to have some getting started tutorials, whether it's YouTube's or some sort of online learning thing that are really carefully and professionally produced, because it would be death to our new academy if a million people showed up and wanted to join forums right away, where if we had an online tutorial sort of thing, you could handle a million people like that. So another angle I want to get into, and John, you're just going to have to be brutal about the shepherding of our time here. I keep finding both within the doctor community and the patient community that there are a lot of people who have opinions, and they'll either pontificate or they'll say it's all BS because XYZ, something like that, when they haven't actually used it. And a really good way for anyone to find out how much somebody is a user is to ask them what's the most interesting or fun thing they've ever done with it. Right? And you usually will get a mumble or a blank stare or something. And the reason I mention this, there was a big thing in the paper in November. There was an article in JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association, about how doctors got beaten at diagnosis by ChatGPT. And that produced an article in the New York Times, which unfortunately had a mangled headline that caused all sorts of distortion. And so in the same way somebody's pissed off at Hugo about his article today, people were mad at. Anyway, the key learning in there, they looked at, so the situation there, there's this library of something like 56 classic difficult diagnostic problems, complete medical file on a patient, and you give it to people to see if they can figure out what the problem is. So they took a selection of these and handed them to three groups. They handed them to doctors without access to AI, and then they handed it to doctors with access to AI, which they thought would be the big winner, and then they also just gave it to ChatGPT with no adult supervision. And it turns out doctors without ChatGPT got 73% right. ChatGPT alone got 98% right, which no human had ever done. And the doctors with ChatGPT got 75% right, only a little bit better. And it turns out there were two main factors for why doctors with AI didn't do a lot better. The first factor was that they didn't use it with an open mind. They continued to do the way they'd been trained to do diagnosis. And along the way, they would ask it a little question. Right? Now, what people like Hugo and us know is that what you need to do, as Hugo just described, is he calls it, giving it a relevant context, giving it all the information you can, and then let it think on its own. And that's how it kicked the butts of the doctors. But the other problem is that most of the doctors hadn't heard how Hugo describes using it. They used it like, so they would ask their one question, they would use it as if it was some big Google. And that means, like, I've decided what the important question here is, and by that time you may have already missed the bus. So what you need to do is give it as much of the problem as you can and say, what do you think about this, or a more specific question. And it's really important. It was doctors who were making this mistake. All right. Now, that's
interesting.
Let me just finish. That can be solved
by
teaching doctors that that's not the way to use it.
I have noticed that with ChatGPT, they have, I don't recall it doing this earlier on, but more recently, it is constantly prompting me to ask it more. It's like, I think they're aware of the issue, you know, the issue that people will treat it like a Google. And they're actually prompting people to ask follow-up questions to make sure that we sort of get into the understanding here that it's a conversation. It's not just a query.
Yeah. Perplexity does it smarter. It provides below, after it provides an answer, it provides a listing of other questions you may have related to whatever it answered.
I wonder I wonder about DeepSeek, whether DeepSeek is actually, obviously it is, apparently it's relatively inexpensive. I wonder if it's going to really become a major AI player, given that there's politics around it.
So John, I'm going to answer because John was deeply interested in open source at the beginning, right? This is a redoing of open source. This is open source for AI. And now that you have, in fact, you have more than one model, you have two or three Chinese models that have come out in the last 2 weeks. Two of them came the day after R1 came out. They suddenly feel like the pressure. And that's it. We are going to have multiple models that are available for us to play with. And that's going to completely change how this entire world is going to deal with it. Well, it's like, do you remember Red Hat? How suddenly when Red Hat happened, the whole world changed.
And whether or not it's DeepSeek per se that takes over the world, the technology, as I'm sure you've read, the technological breakthroughs that they came up with have now been seen by the whole world. And you can bet that people at OpenAI and Perplexity and everywhere else are saying, all right, we got to retool our stuff. And in addition to the enormous price performance benefit that it has, there's also the environmental impact. You know, a big concern has been how much energy is required and the size of the power plants and the and everything. And if it can be done with 50 times less energy, that would be a good thing. And so they demonstrated that it can be done, and everybody's got to be racing to implement something similar. So once again, 2 years ago, the world changed almost overnight. Now here we are, the world changed almost overnight again.
But again, this idea of open source, who today remembers the name Linus Torvalds? No one, I mean, except, yeah, okay. But the vast majority of people will not remember, will never have heard the name. But if you talk about Ubuntu and Red Hat, the number of people is much bigger. I'm not sure that we will still hear about DeepSeek in 2-3 years. We don't know. For me, DeepSeek is like Linus Torvalds.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people miss the fact that technologies evolve and people evolve. And I know that I've been in conversations recently about how early we really are in the evolution of the internet. And we're probably in a transitional phase of the internet. And one of the reasons that we see so many issues with that are internet related is that we're going through a period of adjusting and kind of learning how to adapt to a new way of moving and sharing information. And it was radical change. So 30 years into it, we're not that far along if you compare it to, like, say, the advent of the printing press and how long that took to start having its effects and to become a stable technology, I guess.
You know, I think that there's potential in the open source large language model, large or small language models, in if we think in terms opportunities for consumers of health services and patients to empower themselves, because, you know, you can run a small model on a laptop, even on a Raspberry Pi. I put a great faith in the open source options we have out there. The better off we might be.
Yeah, and I think, as Gilles pointed out earlier, we're talking about, you know, two components. One is the database, you know, the all the learning, all the things that are combined in the huge database that you have with an LLM. And then you have the wrapper is sort of like the technology for querying the LLM. And I think one of the questions about medical uses of the of any kind of artificial intelligence, if we're talking about LLMs, basically, querying LLMs, is whether the data sources are sufficient to provide really good and effective information in response to a medical query.
So we have been talking about garbage in, garbage out for a very long time. But now we're going to face something different. There's going to still be this garbage in, garbage out, but there is also, as we are starting to see, different LLMs are built by different entities, and we don't know what each entity is going to try to hide by not putting some information in or by pushing some version of the information more than some other. That's where I said, this is, as much as I love AI, we really have to be aware of this. So the last couple of days I've been playing with using on Perplexity, using the three main reasoning models and asking exactly the same query and making sure that Perplexity itself forgets about the prior answer before answering the next one. And it's really interesting. There is a big article, I mean, the main article in Nature magazine this week about, are we on our way to a new pandemic with the bird flu? Very scary. So Without providing that article, I went on Perplexity and I used O1, R1, and Perplexity Pro and asked the same question. Are we going to get a new pandemic? And each model is built differently and responds completely differently. So you have some models that are alarmists, some that are, the Chinese one are much more, it's really a Chinese way of thinking, much more stable, and they won't tell you yes or no. And then the third one, which is not full reasoning, uses CDC data and is like really just providing you the facts. But so, all of this means that the way people are going to get the information is going to have a deep impact into how they respond to events or whatever they read.
Yep. Great opportunity for propaganda, huh? So yes. Once again, don't ask it for answers. Use it to help you think.
Mm-hmm.
Think for yourself.
Have either of you used an AI that was built specifically for medical queries versus a more general AI?
You go ahead.
I have used Open Evidence, and I find it extremely open up for everyone. I wish it were, and I don't see a good reason why it couldn't. So, it's a really outstanding tool, and I recently read that it gets about 90% of the answers correct, and it provides references. Very, very powerful tool. And it's, again, I try to be agnostic in terms of which tool I use, and I bounce the same questions a lot of times through different models, and I try to help advance. And I think of like sort of a military commander attacking the enemy from different places with different tools and different war machines. So, anyway.
I just want to say about limitations of AI. I'm always looking for limitations. And I have found some real limitations when you start looking for information regarding rare diseases. So I know, because of my work with ECHO, I know a lot about multiple types of rare cancers. And I chose one, and I tried to get a simple answer from all those LLMs. Where do I find a specialist for leiomyosarcoma? And that's already incredibly, that's not what I expected, but here is one case where it's still too granular a question for the LLMs. They're gonna tell you the big centers are here. It will tell you what it knows about the main hospitals who have a sarcoma unit. But sarcomas are 50, 80 different types of sarcomas. And if you want to be treated for a rare disease, you need to see a team that sees at least 50 cases of that specific disease every year. Otherwise, they do not have the expertise. So I don't care if I lay on my sarcoma. I don't want to be seen by a sarcoma specialist. I want to be seen by a leiomyosarcoma specialist. And that the LLMs is still not able to give me in a simple answer.
And if it is able to give you that information, I wonder if your insurance company will go along with it. There's that question too. Some of the insurance companies, I think, require a PCP referral, and I guess it would just be a matter of convincing your PCP to make the referral.
Yeah, I think that you can ask your PCP. I mean, if you have leiomyosarcoma, that means you have seen more than a PCP already. You have already seen an oncologist. And and if they're honest, they're going to tell you they are not able to treat you and that you should go and see a real specialist. You can find those names, but once again, you can only find it if you have learned how to prompt, to become really good at prompting, and so that you can reverse the question. You can say, can you find for me the biggest doctors or research scientists that have published about leiomyosarcoma over the last 5 years? It will give this to you, and from that you can say, I'm in Pennsylvania. Can you find me the one that are closest to me? And then it will find it. But you will never get that answer if you don't know how to really prompt, seriously know how to prompt those devices.
And when you have a community, you have people who can advise each other
exactly
as to how to do those prompts. And then if you make it more of an academy, I assume that would mean that you find a way to store the knowledge in effective ways so that it'll be easier to retrieve.
We will store all of this into our own LLM. You can be sure of it.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, I think we're about at the end of our hour here, and I really appreciate you guys coming in and talking about this. I think we need to do another one, if
whenever
you wouldn't mind
you
coming back.
Whenever you
okay,
want.
That'd be great. Okay, well, thanks so much. Thanks for joining us, and we will let you know when we publish the episode. And I will just mention to our listeners, if you're listening to this, you can also see the video on YouTube. If you're watching it on YouTube, you can go, or if you're listening to it, you can go to our website at plutopia.io, and we'll include some additional links. And to our guests, if you have links that you want us to be sure and include when we publish, send them on. So
sure.
Thanks a lot.
I mean, everybody should look into Dave's Substack.
We'll definitely have that link.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay. My pleasure.
We'll see you soon.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.